When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
So I know you've got a lot going on. But remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Elon Musk wants to prosecute Dr. Anthony Fauci, because Elon Musk is definitely not an alt-right troll. We have a jam-packed show for you today. The Good Liars will join us to talk about all the fun they have attending MAGA rallies. Doesn't sound that fun, but sure. Then we'll talk to the editor-in-chief of The Verge, Nilay Patel, about Twitter and ChatGPT. But first, we have Nation writer and author of Allow Me to Retort, Ellie Mistal. Welcome to Fast Politics, Ellie Mistal.
Molly, how are you?
I am just always so excited to have you, because you are so smart and interesting, but also hilarious.
No pressure.
No pressure. Yeah, exactly. Be hilarious. No. Let's not be hilarious. Let's talk about the Supreme Court, which is, I feel like, the opposite of hilarious.
It's terrifying is what it is. It's hilarious like a clown.
Right.
Right? It's a thing that should be funny and should be dismissible, but actually is just very creepy and scary.
There are a bunch of cases. I think we should talk about yesterday's case where they're toying with democracy.
Yeah. So yesterday's case is the case to legalize the coup, essentially, right?
It was the oral arguments, and the case is called
Moore v. Harper. It arises out of the North Carolina state legislature, Republican-controlled North Carolina state legislature, making a map that was so partisan, so favorable to Republicans, basically rigged the election in favor of Republican congressional candidates and Republican state legislative candidates, that the North Carolina State Supreme Court threw out the map as a violation of the North Carolina Constitution and ordered it to be redrawn. North Carolina Republicans appealed that decision. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court. But the theory under which they appealed it is what's really troubling. They didn't do the normal thing of just saying, hey, the North Carolina Supreme Court is wrong. Please help us, Mr. John Roberts. Like, that would have been the normal Republican thing to do, right? No. They propagated what's called independent state legislature theory or doctrine, depending on which cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs person you talk to. And this doctrine or theory says that the state legislature and the state legislature alone, through the process of an up or down vote, is the final arbiter on every time, place, and manner, on every aspect of an election held in the state, subject only to the federal constitution's supremacy clause. So while that might not jump off the page as a huge thing,
it does not jump off the page, but yes, continue.
It changes everything, right? It basically means that the state legislature, which will often be controlled by partisans, are allowed to, for instance, draw maps that violate the state constitution, and the state Supreme Court cannot tell them that the state constitution has been violated because only the state legislature can do that. It means that potentially a state board of elections could say, like, okay, we're going to have voting from this day to that day, and it's going to be early voting from here to there. And the state legislators just say no, because only the state legislature gets to determine when the time, place, again, and manner of elections. So we get to decide. It could mean that when the state certification bureau says we have now certified our slate of presidential electors, the state legislature and only the state legislature gets to say, no, 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 we would like to have a different slate of presidential electors. So the entire kind of structure, the kind of nitty-gritty nuts and bolts of how democracy works, these North Carolina Republicans say can only be controlled, can only be adjudicated by the partisan up or down vote of a state legislature.
Wow.
It should come as no surprise to your listeners that the first place where this cockamamie theory was given voice was in 2000 in Bush v. Gore. This theory was adopted by former Chief Justice William Rehnquist in Bush v. Gore. Now, if you guys remember what's, and I'm going to date myself here by like being alive during Bush v. Gore, right? I was a 1-0 during Bush v. Gore. So like it stuck in my mind a bit, right? And right. That 1-0 is a first year law student. And the issue in Bush v. Gore for your younger viewers, listeners, is that the Florida State Supreme Court had ordered a recount of the general election between Gore and Bush in Florida. That was a court-ordered recount following the state court's interpretation of Florida statutory law. It was the Republicans, who usually are all for state rights, suddenly, right, when the presidency was on the line, didn't want to listen to states' rights, didn't want to listen to Florida, wanted to have a different standard of review to find a way to stop the recount. Intellectually, this was hard. So Rehnquist invented this independent state legislature theory that said that it was actually the then Republican-controlled Florida state legislature that had the final authority on whether or not there should be a recount, not the Florida State Supreme Court. Now, it's important to understand that Rehnquist's idea here was rejected by the court. That's not the grounds on which the Republicans made George W. Bush president. They found a different way to stop the court-mandated recount. But that's the first time this theory was put into play. But here's the coda to that story, Molly.
Yeah.
As I said, it was a concurring opinion by Justice William Rehnquist. It was signed only by two other justices, Antonin Scalia, who is now dead, and right, Clarence Thomas, who is very much not. In addition, if y'all remember, one of the lawyers on George W. Bush's team who was pushing this independent state legislator theory was current Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
Oh, interesting.
There's actually a clip of Kavanaugh from 2000. Mark Joseph Stern actually found it. I saw him posted on Twitter the other day. A clip of Brett Kavanaugh in 2000 talking to Wolf Blitzer pushing independent state legislature theory.
Interesting.
That's how this cockamamie theory got started. It was Republicans casting about for a way to make George W. Bush president. And now it's coming back to us as Republicans cast about for a way to legalize, not the previous coup, but to legalize the next coup that they're planning. You know who else is a proponent of independent state legislature theory?
Who?
Jenny Thomas.
Of course she is.
This was one of the theories that she was pushing in her emails to Kevin McCarthy and all the other people that she was trying to get to legalize the coup. So there's an entire kind of, you know, white wing, right wing ecosystem here around the concept of pushing this theory forward so that red state legislatures are able to decide the results of elections as opposed to Board of Elections, nonpartisan commissions, or even the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I want to get back to this for a second. There was some pushback here, though.
It didn't go as badly as I thought. Now, granted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's congratulate ourselves for it not going as badly as we thought. I was reading some pieces about this, and I was surprised that it didn't go as badly as we thought.
Yeah, Democrats 2022, not as bad as possible. I mean,
that's well, this Supreme Court, they really suck. So whenever they are slightly, and I thought it was interesting. It seems like Gorsuch was the one who was the most into the idea. Explain to us what happened.
So Thomas, with his priors, Alito and Gorsuch were all in on independent state legislator theory. Gorsuch was actually particularly odious, and I don't even want to waste a lot of time on this guy because he was literally
really
just trolling,
sucks.
I think, all Black Americans with his questioning.
Right,
but
right,
that only gets you to three.
Right.
Now, again, because of what I said about Kavanaugh, I expected Kavanaugh to be a solid four.
Right.
But at oral arguments, he was a bit weak. I mean, Kavanaugh is like constitutionally like a weak person.
I mean, that's kind of his brand. But yes, continue.
Right. But he was a little bit intellectually washy. He was trying to distinguish Bush v. Gore. And I should just, by the way, mention that at the time of Bush v. Gore,
wasn't he a lawyer for Bush?
That's what I'm saying. He was one of Bush's lawyers.
Yeah. Which is so sketchy. And now he runs the highest court in the land. Continue. Sorry.
That Kavanaugh tried to distinguish Bush v. Gore from the case in front of him from North Carolina. He was trying to make a very, it's a thin slice of the legal pie. He was trying to make a distinction between statutory interpretation, which is what was at issue in Bush v. Gore, versus state constitutional interpretation, which is what is at issue in Moore v. Harper. And he was trying to say that, like, those two things are different and independent state legislature theory works for one, but not for the other. So that was a little bit surprising. I don't know if he'll have the strength of character to follow through with that. But the swing vote was always going to be Amy Coney Barrett. See, John Roberts, right, he doesn't like this theory. Like, it's funny because part of the reason why we're here is because of an earlier Roberts decision. Like, this is a bit of chickens coming home to roost to him. But right, Roberts is not down for this because Roberts' whole thing is to give more power to judges, not take power away from judges, even at the state court level, and put it in the hands of partisan legislatures. That's not Roberts' MO. So Roberts doesn't like independent state legislature theory. But Amy Coney Barrett, like, she has no priors on this, right?
Right.
She hasn't written about this before. She hasn't ruled on this before. She isn't married to a person who tried to support a violent insurrection against the American government.
Yet.
And as far as I know, Molly, and I'm not as schooled in theology as I am on law, but I do not believe Jesus has taken a strong position on independent state legislature theory.
This is why I love you. This is why I love you. Because anyway, yes, I don't think Jesus has a horse in this race.
Right. So if she can't tie this to anything in her prior law, and to anything in Leviticus, to anything in her background, she's in play. Is what I'm saying.
Right.
And based on her questions, she seemed quite skeptical that independent state legislature theory was a thing. Now, and I've written about this for The Nation in an article that's coming out a little bit later today. You always have to be careful with reading the tea leaves on Barrett, because in her brief history, she has actually shown herself to be a very good, thoughtful, smart questioner, where at oral arguments, she seems to really be intellectually getting in to the meat of the issue in front of her. But then when it comes times to vote, all she's done is vote for the most extreme brain dead version of the conservative case possible. Like, she, whatever she does at oral arguments has thus far not linked up to what she does behind closed doors when it comes time to vote. So I don't want to put too much faith in Barrett,
but based
on oral arguments, at least, she seemed extremely skeptical that independent state legislature theory was a thing.
Right. That's so interesting. So she is actually smarter than she votes.
I think she gets a bad rap because, you know, her background coming into the court was so light, and people dislike her for entirely legitimate reasons. But please don't come at her as if she's dumb. She's not a man, basically, right? Like, basically, all of the women on the Supreme Court are smarter than all of the men.
Yeah, you're laughing, but that sounds right to me. It's much harder to succeed in these businesses as a woman. just like it is much harder to succeed at these than when you're black. I mean,
exactly.
This is why the people who get there tend to be much, much, much smarter than the white guys.
You can't be Amy Coney Barrett but have a background like Brett Kavanaugh, right? You can't.
Right.
You can't just fail up and be a woman, even in kind of conservative Republican circles. You know, there are exceptions. Carrie Lake springs to mind for no reason.
Right, Carrie Lake, but she didn't win.
Right, when you're a woman and you get to the level of Amy Coney Barrett, even within conservative circles, there's probably some intellectual heft there, and she has it. She's an intelligent person. Her problem is not that she's dumb. Her problem is that she's an extremist,
or at least
she votes like one. Her problem is that she's a religious wingnut, or at least she votes like one. If you're going to come at her for what she does. Don't come at her for her background, because when you listen to her at court, she is an intelligent person who asks, and again, I can't emphasize this enough, her questions are consistently now over the past 2 years, the best version of the conservative case possible, right? She asked the questions correctly from the perspective of her view, a view that I obviously disagree with. Really, the only stinker was during the Dobbs oral argument, where she kind of went off on a Jesus tangent about Firehouse Babies and
Firehouse Babies.
In 2 years, that's the dumbest thing she said. I do not go through two years and have one thing be the dumb, right? Like she, so it's the dumbest thing she said in 2 years. But other than that kind of obvious problem, she's really intelligent and she asks really good questions. Again, when it comes time to vote, she votes like she's a brain dead Republican.
Right, right, right.
Talks like Kagan, votes like Kavanaugh. That's her problem.
Right. But you, as someone who's covered this court for a long time and who is quite smart, I think what you're trying to tell me is that there is, that the court is a power that changes people. It sounds like, and again, I may be reading between the lines here, but it seems like what you're saying is that people grow into the court.
I'm not quite willing to go that far on her yet.
Right, but it could. You feel like it's theoretically possible.
What I think is true is that Amy Coney Barrett knows what she's doing.
Right.
I think what is still unknown is what she wants to do.
Right.
She's got this power. She understands how it works. She understands how this game is played. The question is what she wants to do with that power. And I always contrast her with Brett Kavanaugh, not just because they are closest in terms of their appointments, but because Brett Kavanaugh is a drooling idiot. When he asks questions, they are the dumbest, most reductive, most bog standard version of the Republican argument. Like he said, there is a lack of intellectual heft that you see with Brett Kavanaugh. And there's also a sweaty desperation just oozing off the man to be liked by the media. Now, I think that John Roberts has gotten a completely he is entirely too respected by mainstream media. They love Roberts. Everybody wants Roberts as their conservative friend. That is the wrong play. Roberts is an enemy of black people voting and has been for his entire career. But the way the media treats John Roberts is the way Brett Kavanaugh would like to be treated. The problem, of course, is that John Roberts, you know, as far as we know, never tried to rape anybody, right? And so, like, he can't get around that, but he would like to.
There's no world in which Kavanaugh will ever not be tainted by what he has done.
Exactly. But he wants to be treated like Roberts. And so all of his little machinations are, even in this case where he's trying to make this distinction, right, between Bush v. Gore and this case. I don't know if he'll follow through on it. I don't know if he just did that because he wants to be liked. He wants to sound reasonable more so than he is. So you can really distinguish between what Kavanaugh does, which is always kind of dumb, but also media facing and whatever, versus, again, what we've seen from Barrett so far, which is to be smart, to be thoughtful, to be probative, but then behind closed doors, just do the Republican bidding. So we still have to see about that. Obviously, the smartest justice on the court right now is Ketanji Brown Jackson. Whew, She comes out swinging hard, taking no prisoners. She has been, and I've said this before, Molly, but like, I'm a grown ass man, right? I'm a 44-year-old man. I'm beyond the stage where I'm like, I hope the Disney character looks like me because I feel like I'm beyond that, right?
Right.
Ketanji Brown Jackson is like me being a 12-year-old and seeing a black princess and being like, maybe I could be a princess someday. Aww. Like, she's that level of affirming. It's not just what she says, but how she says it, the way she attacks an argument. It's exactly the way that I think. It's exactly what I think should be done. And to hear it for the first time in my life coming from a Supreme Court justice, it's just been so affirming and wonderful to listen to her in these arguments. She's gonna lose. I mean, she loses.
Right, because the votes, yeah.
She doesn't have the votes.
It sucks that you have these three pretty incredible liberal justices and then you have like the drunken beer guy. But like, it's not. I mean, can you imagine like the women have like killed themselves to get there? But lawmakers have added a provision in the National Defense Authorization Act. This is I'm reading a tweet from Jane Mayer, protecting Supreme Court spouses from having to reveal any outside employer in the name of security. If it passes, Ginny Thomas's professional entanglements would effectively be state secrets.
Yep, that sounds on brand for Republicans. and I say Republicans, but it also sounds like the kind of thing Joe Manchin would be for, right? Because like,
you
go too far into, there is a desire on the behalf of corrupt politicians for us to not know who's paying for them, right? Like it's in NASCAR, they at least have the dignity to emblazon who bought them on their cars and on their shirts, right? But in American politics, they don't even have that level of dignity, right? They don't want us to know who is funding them because they don't want us to know who actually controls their votes. And so hiding the spouses, it's not a security issue. Nobody's threatening Jenny Thomas's right-wing crazy conspiracy QAnon employers.
Right, she can have it.
It's not a real thing, right? They're doing it so they can hide what these people do. And remember, these people are spouses are, you know, like Jenny Thomas, a lot of the Supreme Court justices have spouses who were public figures before their spouses ascended to the Supreme Court. Unlike Jenny Thomas, they pulled back from public life to avoid the appearance of impropriety. But John Roberts's wife, for instance, Jane Sullivan, was a fierce forced birth lawyer who ran forced birth organizations and pushed relentlessly the legal theories that would eventually be used to overturn Roe v. Wade for her whole life until Roberts ascended to the Supreme Court.
Right. Super interesting. Thank you so much, Ellie. Super interesting. I hope you will come back.
Absolutely, Molly. You guys have a nice one.
Oh, you're the best. Thank you. When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, we are going to give women meaningful beauty. And I said, that's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life.
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Jason Selvig and Davram Stifler are a comedic duo known as The Good Liars. Welcome to Fast Politics, The Good Liars.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us here.
Jason.
Hey, how's it going?
Make your voice sound distinctive.
I can do a Davram impression and...
Yes, good. Do a Davram impression.
No, I'm not going to do that to Davram
no,
right
don't
now.
Do that. Davram, say hi to us so people can.
Hello, everyone. This is Davram here. Jason does a pretty good impression of me. It's on the offensive side, but pretty good. It's good enough that my Siri on my phone picks him up and thinks it's me.
Oh, wow.
Hey, Siri. Oh, wow. My Siri's not going off. Sorry, that was a mistake Jesus. On my part.
Well, you get what you deserve. So anyway, welcome to Fast Politics. I wanted to have you guys on the podcast to talk about all of the stuff that you guys do that is pretty hilarious. I mean, I don't know where we start here. I guess you should start by telling people how you two found each other.
Sure.
Yeah, Davram and I were friends in the city through the comedy scene for years and years, and we didn't like do a lot of comedy together. We mostly were friends from playing basketball together. We would go play pickup games in the city. And then around the time of Occupy Wall Street, we did one video together, a comedy video, where we acted like we were investment bankers that were down there protesting the protesters. And we called ourselves Occupy Wall Street. And we thought we were kind of, you know, we thought it was pretty obvious that we were joking and we were saying ridiculous things like, if you guys keep protesting, we're going to have to give up our house in the Hamptons and quit our cocaine addiction. And we thought it was a pretty obvious joke, but people thought we were real. And the news reported on us like we were real, and real investment bankers came and joined us in the protest.
Yeah, eventually we had a website. We were selling cufflinks for like $300, just like that said 1% on them. Be part of the 1% and buy these. Like everything was supposed to be a joke, was taken seriously.
Oh, wow.
And then real bankers joined us, and we're saying all this that crazy stuff we were saying along with us. It was like this out-of-body experience. We're like, we thought we were, you know, doing caricatures of people, and now here they are joining us.
It's interesting because we had New York Times PitchBot on this podcast, and he said that he used to comment on this conservative blog as a way of trolling them, and they thought he was serious.
Yeah.
It's like the same deal, where it was like, yeah, the more ridiculous we would get, the more people would be like nodding and saying yes, and it was kind of at that point where we realized that like both of us feel comfortable, you know, for better or worse, doing these things in public and doing ridiculous things in public. And from there, we kind of were like we ended up doing a movie on the 2016 election where we kind of got into the world of pranking politicians. And it's kind of evolved along the way, but it's all in the real world. We're putting ourselves in, you know, kind of tricky situations sometimes, but all for the sake of comedy.
I mean, do you guys have anxiety about doing these things? I mean, I don't have any anxiety about public speaking, but I think this might freak me out a little bit.
I think yes is the answer to some degree, but we have gotten used to it. Like there is, as crazy as some of these situations are, there is like a routine to it. Like we go somewhere, we stay in a shitty hotel, we write our little notes about what we want to say, we show up. Like it is kind of tense, but because we've done it enough, there's like a little bit of a routine to fall back on in a weird way. But I think some of the craziness of the situations, you know, doesn't go away over time because there's like a certain amount of danger and it will always be new when you're dealing with real people. So yes, yes and no, I guess.
You know, it's funny because I'm thinking about we had this incredible activist on this podcast, Crackhead Barney.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. She's great.
I said, like, did you ever feel like actually scared? Was there any place where you've ever felt scared?
She got arrested once, right?
She got put in a mental institution once.
Oh really? Gosh. Wow.
That is wild.
That would be scary for me.
Yeah.
Guess where?
Hard yes. Hard yes, I guess would be her answer.
What is Bellevue still? Does that still exist?
No, I mean, guess where was the scariest place she said she'd ever been?
Trump rally.
Staten Island.
That is a scary place, you know?
It is scary. So what do you guys, I mean, where have you felt really like, oh, we're going to get murdered?
January 6th was scary. That was like the thing, the event that we went to that where it definitely took a toll on at least my mental state.
Tell us a little bit about that experience.
We got there like the day before and we were staying in this hotel and people were up all night playing like military pump up music. And so that was like all night the night before. So it just definitely felt like something was coming. Jason, I interrupted a little, but I just felt like we should mention that the January 5th.
Yeah, that was a scary day too.
Almost as crazy. Like Alex Jones and Roger Stone and Ollie Alexander and all those people spoke the night before. People went to that and were just like partying. And
yeah, it was the night before was. We got there on the 5th and we did some interviews and talked to some people. And then we went back to the hotel or checked in the hotel, I don't remember. And we then walked to the Alex Jones, Roger Stone speaking thing. And there were people like Proud Boys or I don't even know who, militia members in bulletproof vests and military gear all around the city that like had a perimeter that were on radios talking to other people. They like basically like owned the city at that point, owned DC. They were the quote unquote police presence there or whatever you want to call it, their own military presence. And then we got to the Alex Jones event and he was speaking and it was like the closest thing I can imagine what it would be like to see Hitler speak at in Germany in the 1930s. Just the way he was speaking, I think we have a video of it somewhere where he's speaking and just screaming and pounding the podium and talking about how it's a war.
Yeah, it's like indistinguishable. He's throwing his fist up and he's like yelling and he's pounding the podium like in rhythm as he's speaking. And it's like, it's not well lit. I don't think they were expecting, you know, as many people as they got there. It didn't feel like it was very organized. Like the chaos was like brewing for sure.
Wow.
It was a very unsettling night. Everything was closed. We couldn't get dinner anywhere. Everything was boarded up. I think people were thinking something really bad was going to happen the next day. And they were right to think that. But then the next morning we went out and we talked to people and just everyone that we spoke to, you know, DeVram has this amazing interview where he talks to a guy who's saying he's going to die in his boots for Donald Trump. Like, everyone was speaking like this was an injustice and it was going to be righted that very day. This was 1776 2.0. We are going to take this thing over. And that's exactly what they tried to do. And we wanted to get out of town before.
Yeah, we started to feel like some bit, like as Trump was about to be finished speaking, we're like, this is probably the time to leave. And then, we were driving along whatever it is, Constitution, is that right?
One of those, I don't remember.
Trying to leave, and we saw like this mob of people. So in the time that we had gotten our car and started to head out of town, Trump had said we're going to the Capitol. And so we were like leaving town, checking Twitter, like no way he actually told them to go there. And he did. And we pulled over and we're like, well, whatever's about to happen, let's at least just not miss it. And then within like 5 minutes, they'd broken through the, you know, the barricades and...
Yeah, there were flashbangs. Yeah, that was the thing that stuck with me was you were seeing these cops like just like getting the hell beat out of them by these people. And we were, right. You know, we were by the steps in the back where they broke through. And you're just seeing these just getting hit in the face with flagpoles, I should say. And it was... I thought that the police, like, for the most part, acted completely heroically and they were just like getting beat up. But I thought at some point one of them was going to pull out a gun and like shoot, because I don't know what I would do in that situation if I was getting beat up and people were trying to get in there to potentially kill members of Congress or the vice president. So whenever a flashbang went off, my first instinct was, oh, bullets are going to fly and I like could get shot right now. And it's probably, you know, better that the, you know, people didn't get shot, with a, you know, the one obvious exception. But that really stuck with me, where I would like try to go to sleep at night, and then I'd be like, kind of had like PTSD for a little bit from that.
I was standing next to this police officer trying to call. He was trying to call for backup, and he was in tears because I think, as far as anyone knew, it was like many, many, many people were dying in there at that moment. Nobody, you know, we didn't have the benefit of any time having passed and watching on TV and getting any reporting. It was like, oh my God, is this happening right now? And then, of course, someone saw our microphone and said we were part of the fake news and kind of like chased us out of there a little bit. Well, and I think at that point we were happy to leave.
Yeah, it was like a group of like 12 guys that like circled around us and said that we were part of the fake news media. And then a flashbang went off and everybody turned around and we were like, all right, that's our cue. Let's make our way to the exit of Washington, D.C. now. We do not want to be here for this.
And oddly enough, like, it was like some people were unaware anything was going on. So like a block away, someone's just like on a run with their dog, the same thing they do every day. Like at that time, it was like, if you weren't in that like block or two radius, like life was just happening ordinarily, it was really eerie.
That is really quite interesting. So tell me, what else have you done that's been weird and strange and interesting?
Well, every Trump rally we go to is weird and strange and interesting. I think you could say all those words. Not the actual rallies. We don't even go in anymore. We don't go in. Like, if you see one Trump speech,
so
you see them all.
They literally are boring. And it goes on forever and ever. I mean, just endless.
We usually get out of there before he even speaks. And yeah, because it's just not worth it. He really is boring. And it's just, if you've seen one, you've seen them all. In the last couple years, we were filming in Georgia with Herschel Walker, and that was interesting.
We were in Kentucky and we just saw a bunch of people wearing shirts, matching shirts, and we thought, is this some sort of like pyramid scheme or something? And we walked into this big auditorium, and it was like 10 a.m. and they were all chanting along and singing along about some sort of like ionized water or something. We never put a video out about it.
Ketones. So I apologize if somebody, a listener, is a member of.
But you can end up in the weirdest places on these trips. It was like it felt like a rave, and it was 10 a.m. and we were the only ones not in these t-shirts.
The thing I'm always amazed by, like when you are sort of going around places, is that there's really strange stuff you can wander into.
You know, it's really just putting ourselves in this situation and going out there. And
the strangest place you can wander into are some of these people's minds, though. Probably like 7 out of 10 people we stop and talk to. Granted, it's a self-selecting group of Republicans at a Trump rally. It's, you know, it's going to be some of the people that are more out there, but it's like 7 out of 10 people are going to say something like that is wild, like really wild stuff.
Right.
It's an actor wearing a mask. We've each heard that like enough times.
Oh, it's an actor?
Oh, no, yeah. Yeah. One woman we talked to said it was Jim Carrey actually playing him. And we were like, Jim Carrey? And we were like,
because Biden tripped going up the stairs and it was so funny that only a genius comedic actor like Jim Carrey could have been doing that.
So wait. So if Biden is Jim Carrey, are they happy with that or no?
That's the thing I can never really understand. One interview stands out to me. It was somebody at CPAC, or I guess outside CPAC. They weren't CPAC, inside the convention. I was talking to him, and he was saying that Joe Biden isn't Joe Biden. It's an actor. Trump is actually still the president. And then I said, well, are you mad at Trump because of the high gas prices? And he said, no, I'm not. And I'm like, well, whose fault is that? And he said, Joe Biden. And I was like, wait a second, you just said Joe Biden's not the president. And it made sense to him. It still doesn't make sense to me, but he was still blaming Joe Biden, even though he doesn't think he's president.
I think the thing they think makes sense to enough sense to them is that there is a bigger plan. They're not concerned with the details, but it's just important to let everyone know that like nothing is as it seems. And once you believe that, then you just need to trust and follow the plan, and the details become like not important.
I mean, you've interviewed the guy who thinks he's JFK Jr.
Vincent Fusca.
That guy doesn't look anything like JFK Jr., even a little.
He's way too tall and handsome.
Yeah, exactly.
For those of you who are not extremely online, the guy who the QAnon people think is JFK Jr. looks like he's about 20 years older and 5 inches shorter.
Yes.
Yeah, and he's actually like some sort of financial consultant that has like lived in Pittsburgh for 30 years. Like there's you know, public records that tell you this is who he is. He's got kids. I think I forget someone we ran into said there, you know, some sibling went to school with his kids. Like this guy is just not
JFK Jr., not even a little.
No, but I think he's like happy to go along with it. Like he's got the weirdest kind of fame. People stop him to take pictures. He's now like, you know, he's got a special spot, you know, somewhere behind Trump at a lot of these things. So I think he's just rolls with it and doesn't really answer any questions, but just like one more piece of weird shrapnel in all of this stuff that is going on is that now there's a little famous JFK Jr. walking around.
What about the guy who wears the brick wall suit?
Jason.
Oh, yeah. I just interviewed him. Yeah, I just thought, it was interesting because he was saying,
by the way, for those who are not incredibly online, this is a guy who goes to all of Trump's rallies and wears a suit that looks like a brick wall. So he's the build the wall guy.
He's the build the wall guy. But he was the guy I talked to. He was very clear. He's like, I just want to be clear. There's two of us.
Oh, gosh.
There's two of us. And I might not be the guy you're thinking. I'm at all the rallies, but I don't know if you might be thinking of the other build the wall guy. But I do okay. I do want to disagree with what you guys were saying, because I actually do believe that Vincent Fusca is JFK Jr.
You want that on the record, huh?
Yes, I want that on the record.
By the way, this Vincent Fusca looks like he's significantly older than JFK would be Jr. if he were still alive.
Yeah. It's almost like he's not him, but you can ask Jason.
That's what they want you to believe.
It doesn't jive at all.
No, it's very, very weird.
Back to the wall guy. Jason talked to him for kind of a long time and got him on a kind of a, you know, our biggest problem is China thing. And they went on that for a while. And meanwhile, the tag of the guy's suit is just sticking out, you know, out of the back of his neck. And, you know, Jason asks to see the tag, and the suit's made in China, in case anybody wanted to know out there.
Yeah, the build the walls suit.
When you ask them about that, what do they say?
He was like, oh, yeah, it's hard to get anything else from another place. So I had to get it from China. It's just like, you know, you could spout off for a million years. And we've had that a couple times where people would talk about China, how much they hate it. And then you like be like, can I see your hat? And it's made in China. You know, it's just like I don't want to say the jokes write themselves sometimes, but it's. And I think
one guy, he had all these flyers. He was like, COVID is China's fault. You know, it's terrible. He thought COVID was the worst and it came from China and we needed to be holding China accountable. That was his whole shtick. He had like a table with flyers. He was handing them out. He was talking to people and made in China hat.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. Thank you guys so much. I hope you'll come back.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, anytime.
Nilay Patel is the editor and chief of The Verge and host of the podcast Decoder. Welcome to Fast Politics.
Thank you for having me.
We're so excited to have you. We are in this it's the Twitter files, right? We got to talk about the Twitter files. You are the editor of a tech publication. You have spent a long time in tech journalism. What the fuck is happening?
Yeah, I have spent a lot of time in tech journalism. The Verge has published a lot of stories about content moderation over the years. We've been nominated for like major journalism awards for our big exposés of how content moderation really works at these companies. I have a lot of sympathy for a good content moderation story. It is a very complicated thing that big companies do. And every time you peel back the layers of the onion, you're like, at the center of it, there's just like a couple of people who are like, I don't know, take it down. Right. Like, it's very, right, and you, right. Like, you build up all of these processes to try and make it fair to like let everybody sleep at night. And then kind of at the end of the day, it's, well, we don't have a rule, but it sucks. Take it down. Right. And right. You just see this over and over again. And kind of the furthest version of this, the most like built up version of this, is like Facebook literally set up a Supreme Court.
Right.
They have an oversight board that is composed of famous lawyers and politicians. That is a Supreme Court for them because they don't want the responsibility. So that's just the stage. I just want to put that out there. Like, this is a very hard thing that social media companies have to do. There are lots and lots of pressures placed on them to take all kinds of things down for some reasons that are really good, right? Like, some content is illegal. Some content is like really damaging to teenage girls. Some content is just like openly racist. Some content, their advertisers who pay all their bills don't like, some content governments just don't want to have exist. So they face all these pressures and they build all these systems. What's hilarious about the Twitter files, like what they are exposing, is a bunch of like diligent nerds doing boring stuff.
Right.
It's like they haven't exposed, like the Twitter would happily have told you all of the things.
Right. And they did, right? I mean, it's in the terms of service.
It's not even in the terms of service. Like, Twitter's been very open. Jack Dorsey is very open. We made the wrong decision about the Hunter Biden New York Post story. So they changed their mind. Like, started allowing the links to go up. I think you have to recall that in the moment that story was published, no one knew the provenance of that information. No one knew where it had come from. And there had been in the past,
like WikiLeaks.
Yeah, like these hack and leak operations beyond WikiLeaks, like iCloud.
McCrowan leaks, right?
McCrowan leaks. If you will recall, a bunch of famous women had their iCloud accounts hacked and their nudes leaked. Like, that's a real thing that has happened in the past. Sony had its email systems breached, and the president of Amy Pascal had her emails leaked all over the place, including like her very intimate shopping list on Amazon, right?
Yeah, but that's because they got North Koreans really, really mad.
It's true. But so all of these platforms like develop these policies that are like, you know what? Like, we're complicit in this thing. And like, we're complicit in someone hacks your system and says, pay us the ransom in Bitcoin, or we'll like leak all your emails. And we don't want to be complicit. So like, they developed all these sort of like hair trigger, shut it down systems that got, in that context, overheated, overdone, and then they changed their mind. And it's like, yeah, okay, it sucked. You made the wrong decision. But they weren't, none of those executives are running around saying this was the right decision. They all admit it was the wrong decision. And so I think what you're seeing with the Twitter files, particularly the second set, where it's like, some people on Twitter had their reach suppressed. It's like, yeah, dude, like they say it out loud. Like, they were not unclear about what they were trying to do. They were trying to make the platform more pleasant. It's just, it is being presented as though it is this ongoing scandal, as the things are revealed. And I think what everyone is going to come to learn, what we have come to learn doing hundreds of content moderation stories over the years, is once you like fall all the way down the rabbit hole of talking about content moderation, but people just tune out. It's just boring.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. What I think is pretty interesting about Elon's Twitter purchase is that we've seen him. He's like literally living out loud. Like, he's doing everything that Twitter has done, right? He went back and, you know, he said, we're going to just let everyone get verified. Okay, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do no content moderation. Oh, well, we're not going to do that. I mean, it does seem like he gets to the same place that Twitter is anyway.
Yeah. So I just talked to Matt Mullenweg, who's the CEO of a company called Automattic. They're the holding company that owns WordPress. They also own Tumblr. He's the CEO of Tumblr as well. And, you know, they bought Tumblr from Verizon for like nothing, for like $3 million. And it was like, he said to me, this has been the most humbling experience of my career, owning a social network. Like, we bought it for nothing. Like, we bought it for the smallest amount of money that anybody would feel good about. It was losing money. It has all these users. Tumblr has all the famous content moderation problems. It got kicked off the app store already. And he's like, our roadmap is basically Twitter's roadmap. We want to reduce our reliance on advertising income. We want to build some subscriptions. We want to do creator, all the stuff that Elon says he wants to do. And he's like, Elon is quickly going to get to the place where he already was. Because once you start going down the road, you can be as libertarian about speech as you want, but there's all this stuff that is horrible that drives away your users, that drives away your advertisers, that limits your ability to grow, that makes you feel bad about being the CEO of a social network that you're going to want to just not have. The example he gave, I think this is like impossible to argue with. There is a community of people out there who are pro anorexia, and they run around telling people to be anorexic, specifically young women. And they're like, you should just not surface that content. You should not give that content reach. You should not feel good about running a service where that content is allowed to proliferate. And at some point, no matter who you are, what your beliefs, you're just going to run into the reality of millions of people are using my service. They're chaotic. They cannot be controlled. And I have to make some decisions about what will happen here or what I won't allow. And it is not for nothing that every major social network in this country more or less arrives at the exact same position around content moderation, because that's just the reality of the constraints if you want to grow your business.
So now this Barry Weiss thing, I thought was interesting. They were so breathless. Like, you know, they're like, and then every reveal, I mean, and you saw it with Matt Taibbi too, that every reveal was like, and then they said, da da da. I mean, there was no smoking gun yet, right?
Yeah, my favorite part of the Barry tweet storm, I'm pretty sure it was hers, was she was like a secret committee composed of Jack Dorsey, the CEO, the head of trust and safety, the company's lawyer. And it's like, yeah, that's the top of the company. that's the company. Like,
it's the C-suite, right?
Yeah, it's the C-suite of the company. Like, right. You're saying that problems with like tricky problems in content moderation were escalated to a committee at the top of the company that then made a decision and they were somewhat unaccountable. Like, have you ever worked at a company? Didn't you work at the New York Times? Like one of the most famously hierarchical and political media companies? Okay, there's just an element of people reacting to the world as though it's a scandal, which is built into all of this. And I think that's fine. You know, like I was once a teenager who reacted to the state of the world as though it was an ongoing scandal.
Right.
I just don't think you're going to get a lot of traction with, you know, the sort of mainstream consumer of Twitter by saying, did you know that the CEO of Twitter often makes capricious decisions? It's like, yeah, that is the experience of using Twitter. It has been for a decade. Did you know Mark Zuckerberg is very powerful? Yeah, great.
Do you think that Elon will just keep going and keep doing these? I mean, they get attention from a certain group. They don't necessarily move the needle. They do seem to be getting more and more boring. The end game here, again, I have heard from people, and again, I don't believe this, but I've heard that Elon's goal is to drive down the value of the company so he doesn't have to service the debt. I don't know how he could do that, because I think the distressed investors, the investors who are good at getting money for people who buy stuff that they can't afford, in this case, he can afford it, but he doesn't want to pay for it. I don't think they're going to let him do that. But does that look like the end game to you here? Or do you think he's just like having fun?
I think mostly he's having fun. I don't think the end game is failure. Elon is a risk taker. I think he enjoys the gamble. And, you know, the people he surrounds himself with, you know, their metaphors for everything are like high stakes poker. Fine. I actually applaud the idea that you should take immense risks with the products that you make. I think that's cool. I think there's like an element that's fun. I don't think his goal is failure so he can get out of a financial obligation. And certainly there were reports this week that some of the banks are willing to accept Tesla's stock and revalue the loans. And we'll see. There's just some financial engineering here. I do think there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley, a lot of investors who are like, all of these companies are too bloated. And this is the first time we're ever going to run an experiment like this where we just destroy a company's culture and rip out all of the fluff just indiscriminately and see what happens. Like, what if Meta could be 50% of its size and still operate? Like, that company would just produce profits, like massive profits. What if Google could be half the size of itself and still be Google? That company would just print money, because they wouldn't be paying for all this stuff that, you know, a lot of people in the Valley think is meaningless or useless. And Twitter is much smaller than those companies. I remind everybody all the time, when you talk about big tech, it is an error, a category error, to say Twitter is part of big tech. Twitter is teeny tiny. He fired 50% of the people and he still only has 2,000 some people. It's like nothing. Twitter in a year makes less money than Facebook makes in a quarter, right? So like, this is a tiny company, but it is the first and only time an experiment like this has been run, where you just gut the company, you reset the culture, you get rid of all the institutional knowledge that most smart business experts would tell you is important to sustain a company, and you see what happens. And thus far, the experiment has been working out, right? At least on one level. I experience all kinds of weird errors on Twitter left and right. I feel personally less motivated to tweet, to like make content for free for the service, but but it's still up, it's still working, it's surviving the World Cup. So I think there's just an element of just experimentation. Like, I think everyone's curious, and I think because of the people involved, they want to go, they want it to succeed so they can go out to the other companies they're invested in or the other companies they run and say, you know what, what if we just delete 50% of it?
That's a sort of fascinating and a little bit dystopian. I always thought of Twitter as the people who worked at Twitter were always sort of the most kind of upstanding and the least evil. You know, they were earnest in a way. So I see what you're saying, but it's very depressing.
And that earnestness is probably why Twitter was like a bad company. Criticizing Elon's administration of Twitter is in no way praise for the previous administration.
Right.
Or the administration before that. Like, this has not been a well-run company. Often the earnestness that you describe or the sincerity, and I certainly have experienced that sincerity, fully got in Twitter's way when it came to being a well-run company with a path forward to be successful. And actually, Elon buying the company, one person showing up and being like, yeah, I'll just buy the whole thing. Like, doesn't usually happen, right? And a board of directors does not usually look at an offer like this and be like, you know what? We have no fucking plan to get to a valuation of $44 billion. There's nothing we can do. And this guy sucks. And there's no one else. Screw it. Like, let's take the cash and walk, which is the decision the board of directors Twitter made. And that to me is as damning as anything.
Right.
They had no ideas for how to get to this valuation. So yes, it's true. As a company, as a culture, as individuals, very earnest, very sincere.
Right, but not earnest enough not to cash out, right? They weren't like, my principles are worth more than this moron who's overpaying. I mean, he's not a moron, obviously, but you know what I mean? He's overpaying for the privilege of taking over.
Yeah, and maybe he'll crash the car off a cliff and maybe he won't. But like, Twitter was successful despite itself. It was successful because it attracted so many users, but it was not successful as a business. Say what you will about Meta. And Meta is like the comparison here because it's the other large social networking company. Mark Zuckerberg has conviction, right? And like, he's the god emperor of that company. You can't get rid of him. And it's going to do whatever he wants. And he is clear that like, what he wants is for all of us to like put our brains in vats and live in the metaverse. And like, fine, he's going to try to do it. Twitter had no conviction, right? It had no center. It was just, it continued to exist despite itself. And I think that to me is damning of the administration of Twitter, the previous administration, as it is damning of Musk, who's like, screw it, I'm going to throw it all off the cliff, including the good parts. I'm not even going to evaluate the parts of this that were working. I'm just saying, screw it. Now it's a payments app.
That's delightfully dystopian. We need to talk about the CGI chatbot that's going to destroy all of our careers and replace us. Are we going to be replaced by CGI chatbots?
GPT is what you're talking about. GPT,
yes. GPT, whatever. Many initials put together.
Our cameras are off, but I could personally use some CGI. So maybe that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, GPT, I think GPT is really fascinating.
Will you explain to my dad what it is?
Sure. If you took a robot and you said, I want you to read the entire internet, and then you said, now what you are is the world's fanciest Microsoft Word autocomplete system, and I'm going to ask you a question, and you're just going to guess what the next word of the sentence should be in response to that question. And that's really what it's doing. It's not alive. It's not thinking. It just has a map of all of the language on the internet and the probability that some words come after another in response to prompts. And so it's just a really, really fancy autocomplete, and obviously a very impressive autocomplete, and in some cases a deeply hilarious autocomplete, but it's autocomplete. And so there's limits to it, right? And there's limits that are imposed by the people who make it, OpenAI. It won't answer some questions. It will happily tell you it's not a search engine all the time. But then there are things, and this is like a great phrase that our reporter, James Vincent, who covers AI for The Verge, told me about. This amazing phrase, it's called the capability overhang, which is you invent a system like this, the AI researchers and developers they're not as creative as the whole internet. So then you give it to the whole internet and you start discovering all the stuff that you had no idea could do. And then you're like off on the cliff being like, whoa, we didn't think about that. Should we slow it down? And I think that's the thing we're all experiencing right now. These models have existed for years. In fact, the core technology of ChatGPT is around like 2020. What they made was a user interface for it that's really fun, right? They made it a chatbot. But Google has demoed this kind of technology for a long time. Microsoft has demoed it. I don't know if you recall this, but a couple of months ago, there was a Google engineer named Blake Lemoine who was like, Google's chatbot is alive. And he got fired because Google's like, this thing is definitely not alive. Right? Like, it's super not alive. There was actually, Google had another controversy with a woman named Timnit Gebru, who was one of their ethics researchers. And she published a paper about a concept called stochastic parrots, which is fundamentally like, if you train a bot like this on the text of the internet, it will reflect the biases of the internet at large. Right? It can only reflect to you what is on the internet. And that means it will be sexist, it will be racist, but then people who talk to the robot will assume that the robot is more accurate than the internet at large, right? So that you will ask it some question, it will deliver you some like racist or wrong answer. And it will be so confident that people will like assume that that is correct. And she got run out of Google for this paper. So Google has like put this technology that they have in a box, right? Their version is called Lambda. And they kind of afraid to use it. And then this other company is like, here you go. Like, let's burn money, like running GPUs to do AI for people. And I think that's really fascinating, right? And I think we're just in a moment where it's like very faddish and very fun. There are some of these that are like hilarious. Like I saw one that's like, tell me why I shouldn't put a banana in a VCR, or it was a peanut butter sandwich. It was like, tell me how to get a peanut butter sandwich out of a VCR in the style of the King James Bible. And that's like just like on its face, like a hilarious improv prompt, right? And then the robot is like just spits out a Bible verse about peanut butter sandwiches and VCRs. Like, that's great. I think like who's going to really use it is a bunch of like mid-level content marketers to be like, here's a blog about health insurance, right? And like, right. That's fine. But what it cannot do is come up with new ideas, right? Because it is just an autocomplete. It's only guessing the next word in a sentence based on the words that already exist on the internet, which means it can do like neat things like pretend to write code. But if you are the sort of person who like makes new sentences, I think you're safe for now.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear my job is safe. Thank you so much for coming on. I hope you will come back and talk to us as the world ends slowly.
Yeah, this is super fun. Thank you for having me on.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Molly Jungfast.
Jesse Cannon.
These Republican night out in New York, they always lead to so much drama. First, there's the Proud Boys. Now it's the I would have done the insurrection right speech.
I did not see it coming. I'm sorry. That was really bad. But Marjorie Taylor Greene is, of course, going to be our moment of fuckery today. New York Young Republican Club had their annual gala on Saturday night where the group's president declared total war on perceived enemies. He said, we want to cross the Rubicon. We want total war. Let me just tell you what's not happening. Total war. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the head of the intellectual dark web of the GOP Congressional Caucus, told the group, I will tell you something. If Steve Bannon and I organized that, she's talking about January 6th, we would have won, she said, as the attendees erupted in cheers and applause. Not to mention, it would have been armed.
This was right after they gave her the Richard M. Nixon Award, which is really, really something.
Yeah, you'd think Richard Nixon would want better, but yeah. We know that he would not. It's very on brand for the Richard Nixon Award. And for that, they are our moment of fuckery. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship. With thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves, so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
So, I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.